cell phones.
Fine time. I'm sorry?
Not drinking today.
89 Melatira. Boker Tov. Boker Tov. We thank our Kadosh Baruch Hu for every drop that falls and every drop that will continue to fall tomorrow afternoon, Friday. Get ready for a mobble. We're getting a major winter storm in the next 48 hours. And it will be throughout the country, including the vitally important area of the north, but we'll get some as well. Just be careful in the slippery places, okay? We don't need people falling and, God forbid, getting hurt. Just be careful. And if it snows one day in this winter, watch it from the window. Yeah.
I was told this morning that something very important for everybody who has a Merit Pesach, that there's a warning on the newspaper, on the radio, to secure everything you have on your Merit.
Because there's going to be heavy winds. Right, there's going to be heavy winds. This is going to be a whopper of a storm. Tomorrow, starting in the afternoon, the winds are going to pick up already in the morning. So that was a very important announcement. If you have things loose on the porches, bring it in or strap it down or cover it, with, you know, that the cover doesn't blow off either. And in those kinds of storms, you can kiss your umbrella goodbye. So don't even bother. Don't even think of it, you know. Just try other headgear besides umbrellas. Because it's not going to stand up. Even if you spent 90 shekel for the great umbrella, it's not going to stand up to the winds. So just be aware. You were warned. You were warned. But in such inclement weather, sometimes just play it safe, and something can be postponed. You know, so you do it some other time, and just stay indoors and you weather it out, and hope your heat, your home is heated nicely, and so on. But we need the rain, as we all well know, and. Kadosh Baruch Hu hopefully is listening to our tefillot in this regard, and even after tomorrow's and Friday's storm, we'll still need more. So, but we have to thank the Kadosh Baruch Hu for every drop. And I already said this more than once, in the name of the Rav, that this is the fundamental idea of Hallel, that you don't just say a general bracha in the morning, that you thank God I woke up, but you go down to details. And you talk about the fact that you opened your eyes and you got dressed, you took your first step, and so on. Every stage of Hashkamat Boker, of waking up, deserves its own bracha. And so too, Kol Tipa V'Tipa, every drop. So of course, the whole is the sum of the parts. We know that from mathematics. But we do not ignore the sum of the parts. So the parts are very, very important. And so too, with regard to our religious / spiritual behavior. So there's a whole composite called being a shomer or shomeret Torah mitzvot. But then there are the details. There's a particular mitzvah, a particular halacha, and particular minhag that are of vital importance. And we do not assign small significance to the very, very detail of a particular mitzvah. Getting back to the general subject of this year's study of Torah and science, so I'd like to move to the field of psychology. Now, I'm not a trained psychologist, but let me just tell you an anecdote of an uncle of mine, my father's older brother. His name was Rabbi Yaakov Adler, Zechron Lebracha, and he served as a rabbi in the Bronx. Those who don't know, that's one of the boroughs in New York City, where was the birthplace of mine. What? You were born in the Bronx? My older brother from Teaneck always said I was born in the zoo. Because, you know, the Bronx Zoo. Yeah. But and he was born in Yankee Stadium. You know, both are in the Bronx. Everybody, okay, we said that. But there was a neighborhood called Kingsbridge, and my uncle was the rabbi for 25 years of the Young Israel of Kingsbridge. And then at the age of 50, you know, as they say, plus minus, you know, the turf. There was the Kingsbridge Shul of Rabbi Izzy Miller, Zichron Lebracha, so that area. So there was Young Israel of Kingsbridge. So when he was about 50, plus minus, he changed the course professionally, and he became a clinical psychologist. And he actually got a PhD at that year in age 50 from, I think it was NYU. You imagine that year to, you know, to go back to school and do a doctorate and then to open up a practice and so on. And I once asked him, I said, why did you do it? I mean, there's a man who really loved to give drashot. I remember after he left the rabbinate, every family occasion, you know, a sheva brachas, an engagement, this and that, just to be asked to get up and say a dvar Torah for him was music. And you can see he still had it in him, and he very much wanted it, and he missed it to a certain degree. So I said, why did you leave the rabbanus? He said, look, as a rabbi, I was engaged in pastoral psychology all the time. You know, people came with their issues and their problems and so on, but you weren't getting paid for it. So here, you become a clinical psychologist and you give a bill. You're doing the same thing, he said. So it's without the drushes. So the truth of the matter is, I had this experience once where a couple came to me on a marriage counseling issue, and I'm the first to admit where I hit a dead end where I'm not the address. You know, I think that's very important for people in all fields to recognize you're not the address, but the chokhmah is to know who is the address, where the person can get help, and you're doing the person a service, and it's not just, you know, a cop-out. They're not saying, you know, I don't want to deal with it, so go to that person. I honestly try to help a person who, if I can, but if I can't, so I try to evaluate what the issue is and try to refer to someone who's more capable and more professional and so on. So I asked a couple, I told them, I said, you know, you need serious marriage counseling of a professional. And I said, I really can't do this for you. I'm not trained or equipped to do it. I mean, love to sit with you hours and schmooze, but that's not what's going to happen here. What are you coming to me for? And their response was very clear. You're free. That's what they said, unabashedly. You're free. You don't give up a bill. Come and sit with me, and, you know, for an hour or two. I'm not going to get a bill. So I said, okay, Beseda, but you know, you're getting free service. You're getting bad service also. You know, you get what you pay for, I said. So I said, you know, do yourself a favor. If you want to work out your problems, deal with it professionally and so on. There are some times that there's a mix between, and this, I happen to be on the phone call, you know, list of some doctors, some counselors and so on. Sometimes there are halakhic issues that come up in counseling that there's a need for halakhic opinion where the doctor or the counselor says, I'm not trained for this. I need a rav to tell me, you know, which way to go with this. Or is it, it's, I think I want to do this, but maybe it's asur, maybe it's prohibited. So they will call and, you know, and I'll listen to the story, you know, in confidence and try to give some type of guidance. So that's important. That's important. There's a very, very competent psychiatrist who I was neighbor with in Ramot. He has an office not far from here, Dr. Gary Quinn. He wants to write a book with me together, but just to put together our mutual experiences of working out problems with people, and we should do it. The truth is, there are just so many hair-raising stories and how we were able to work things out for people, but it was a joint effort of the world of halacha and the world of psychology or psychiatry to try to get to the bottom of what the necessary tipul therapy would be. And I think that's very, very, very encouraging. When I was in camp, remember there was such a thing called summer camp? You know, camp. So when I was, we don't even use the word sleepaway camp, because if it was a sleepaway camp, we used to call it day camp. Right, so camp. So some of you might remember the name Camp Mogen Avraham, as it was popularly known as Mogen Av by the guys in the 60s. And it existed just until a few years ago. My brother from Teaneck went from 1962 until it closed down practically. You know, some people just never leave. It's not that you're a camper. You know, you work your way up, you know. But at one point in my adolescent life, it was when I was turning in between 10th and 11th grade, I decided to declare independence from Yossi Adler. Because I had enough being Yossi Adler's brother. I was a year behind him. Every single year, I had his teacher, and my brother was a very fine student, and there was these expectations levels that were there, and I had to live up to them. Bad enough, I lived up to my parents' expectations, but I had this brother of mine, you know, who was also a very fine student, and both in the Limud HaKodesh and in general studies. And here I was, you know, Nebuch, you know, I had to rise to the occasion because there was a lot of pressure. So so too in Camp Mogen Avraham, we both started out, I was 10 years old, he was 11, and then we grew up, you know, in the ranks and became counselors and not counselors, you know, CITs, counseling training, and so on. That guy took a different course. I became a lifeguard. I was in the waterfront, and he was not in the waterfront. Right? So at least a little identity issue there. But then at one point I said, Gamarna, I'm going to a new camp. Nobody ever heard of Yossi Adler. And I'm going to start scratch. And it was very healthy for me. Very, very good. And all of a sudden I found that the owner of the camp was actually a brother of the camp from Magen Avraham, the family Greenwald from Muncie, New York. So from Camp Magen Avraham was Rabbi Ronnie Greenwald, Zichron Lavracha. I just died a year or two ago. Extremely fine person. And I went to Kolrina. Do you remember Kolrina? You went to Kolrina. You were in my bunk. You were the guy who made me trouble. I was a lifeguard in Camp Kolrina for a few seasons. And there was another brother, and Dr. Greenwald. He was a big Talmid Chacham. He was also he claimed to be a psychiatrist. He was a psychologist, but he was a pseudo-psychiatrist, let's just say, call it that, for better word. He wasn't really an MD, but he was a psychologist. And I remember learning something by him in an evening session to the staff, where he taught some Torah. He quoted source number 5. Look at the page, source number 5. And I'm giving him credit, because I never would have understood this on my own. The Gemara Masechet Brachot, based on the Mishnah, so let me quote the Mishnah by heart. The Mishnah says that on Al Shmot Tovot, on good tidings, you say the Bracha HaTova Meitiv. And there are different examples of when you say Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam HaTova Meitiv. Right? You hit the jackpot in a lottery, so you have to make a Bracha HaTova Meitiv. You know, you have to thank Kadosh Baruch Hu that you just came across with a lot of money. The Gemara says that if you're the sole benefactor, so you don't make a Tova Meitiv, make a Shech Hayana. But if you have to share it, the two people bought the lottery ticket together, so you have to share the prize, so you say, Atov v'hameitiv. It's Tov for you, it's Meitiv for the next guy. Fine. So here, and then it says, Al Shmod Ra'ot, God forbid, bad tidings, and the only bad tidings that the Mishnah can think of is the passing away of an immediate relative that you're obligated in Shiva, in Avelut. You have to say, Dayana Emet. So, who says, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Dayana Emet? Those who are ripping Kriya, usually we do it today right before the Levaya. And all of us, if we hear bad news, we say Baruch Dayan Emet, but that's like a quasi-bracha, because if we don't say Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, we've taken the halachic energy out of the bracha. So it's just a zechel bracha. But it's not the real bracha. Baruch Dayan Emet is not the real bracha. The real bracha is Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Dayan Emet, and only a person who's obligated in Evel is required to make that bracha. So here, the Gemara tells us in source number 5, the Gemara brings a proof for something and brings a braita. Mate aviv v'hu yorsho. Man's father died, so the father was a billionaire, and he now inherits $1 billion because of the death of his father. Now that's both bad news and good news at the same time. At the same time, simultaneously, he's now hearing something that impacts as shmot tovot and shmot ra'ot. So he says, batchila, so what the Chazal didn't ask the question, does he have to make two brachot? It was obvious he has to make two brachot. The question of the Chazal was, which comes first? Which comes first? So Gemara says, batchila, omer baruch dayan emet. He says the bracha, baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam dayan emet. And afterwards, he says, baruch hatov v'hameitiv. Later in the Gemara, it says, that's when he's going to share the Yerusha, but if he's the only Yoresh, so he says a shechianu. So okay, besides, that's a different, it's an issue of which specific bracha of simcha. Shechianu is a bracha of simcha. When do we say it? On Yom Tov? We get a new suit or a new dress and so on. There's an element of simcha. So where's the simcha? You're going to sit shiva now? You just became a millionaire. No, that's a simcha, no? You didn't lift the thumb to earn it. And because of your father's passing, you became a very wealthy person. So that's a simcha. So I remember Dr. Greenwald saying, if you would ask the person who just sustained the loss of his father, would you trade your father being alive for the $1 million? I'm not sure how many people are going to answer this question correctly, but the assumption is a person would say, I'd rather have my father alive than inherit the $1 million. There's some people in America who would think otherwise, but because of misguided priorities. But the way Halakha views this is that's what a person would say. I remember the Rav saying in one of the Tshuva Drashas, one of the Yahrzeit Shiurim for his father on Gimel Shvat, and this was those who saw the movie of the legacy of the Rav that was produced about 11 years ago, said this little point was mentioned there. The Rav said once, quoting his father at a Yahrzeit Shiur, And he says, what I wouldn't give to have my father here for 5 minutes. And this was 40 years after his father, 30 years after his father passed away. He says, what I wouldn't give, I'd give everything, everything. So I can have my father here for 5 minutes. I mean, that's an authentic Jewish response. So obviously a person would say, you know, okay, forget it. Now, my father's not here, so I inherited $1 million. So what's really dominant is the evil. And if the evil is dominant, how can you reflect upon the simcha? Maybe after the shloishim, you should say a shechianu. Maybe after the year, you should say a shechianu. Why didn't the halacha simply put the shechianu or the hatov ha-meitiv on hold? Because, by the way, there is no end limit for saying such a bracha. Person buys a new suit. So there's a, when do you make the bracha? When do you begin to be obligated? So that's a little bit of a machloket. Some say at the time of the purchase, and some say at the time that you're wearing it for the first time. As they say, nafkamina, in the Gemara's expression, what's the difference? What comes out of that? Can you buy a new suit in the 3 weeks? Can you buy a new suit in the sphira? Where these are days that we don't, or during Shnat Evel. Person is during Shnat Evel, where we reduce the saying of Shechianu as much as possible. So if you only say Shechianu when you wear a suit, so what's the difference if I bought it a day before Tisha B'Av? I'm not wearing it today. And then after Tisha B'Av, I'll put it on. So I'll make a Shechianu. Or if a person buys a suit, let's say in the 11th month of Evel, and will wear it after the first yahrzeit, I'm not wearing it now, so I'm not making a shechianu. But if you make a shechianu at the time of the purchase, then you don't even purchase new clothing during the days of Evel, whether it's private Evel of the 30 days for all relatives, 12 months for father and mother, and the periods of Omer, and the periods of 3 weeks before Tisha B'Av, and so on. And that, by the way, is the general minhag. Unless there's a compelling reason that a person has a wedding 2 days after Tisha B'Av, which is really okay, and a woman says, I don't have a dress yet for the wedding, you know, and she's nothing less than the mother of the kala, so, you know, she's not going to wait till the day after Tisha B'Av to start trying on dresses if it needs some mending. So there, you know, every good sensible rabbi will say, listen, as long as before the 9 days, you know, try to get it in before for the Rosh Chodesh Av. And so, there are all kinds of heterim. But the bottom line is, we try to stay away from new purchases in the 3 weeks, and new purchases for sure between Pesach and Lag B'Omer, and so on. And if it's the Shnat Evel, the same thing. We try to stay away from it. So what happens when such a person buys it in the 3 weeks and doesn't make a Shechianu, but later on he puts it on? Or worse, person puts on their garment for the first time, forgot to make Shechianu. So you can make a Shechianu the second time wear it? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. Well, you buy a new car. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, by the way, even on a second-hand car, you make a Shechianu. Why? For the first guy, it was junk. But for you, it's new. So it's a new kli. Yeah, it doesn't say that acquiring a new kli, a new tool, or a new machine or something, it has to be brand new. For you, it's new. Even though it's second-hand, Rav Moshe says that even on a second-hand car, you have to make a Shechianu. So when they make the Shechianu, same thing. You signed the contract, you know, when you sold it, you gave the guy money, you got the keys, you drove it for the first time, drove it off the cliff for the first time. I mean, the question is, when do you make the Shechianu? So most of us really have the custom that we do it, make the Shechianu the first usage, first wearing of a garment, of a dress, of a using of a machine. That's usually the minhag. I remember when they came out with Rav-Kav, you know, the cards in the... it's a few years already we have Rav-Kav. But at the beginning, a lot of people didn't know how to use it, what to do with it. I got my first Rav-Kav, it was 2 days before Tisha B'Av. I remember this. I don't know why, I bought it on the street. They had these booths from Eged. And I got a Rav-Kav. And I get on a bus, and I'm using it for the first time. And I looked at the driver, who doesn't have a kippah on, and I say, I think I have to make a Shechianu on my first use of the Rav-Kav. But you know, it's 2 days before Tisha B'Av. So he tells me, Efshar levarech Shechianu gam achrei Tisha B'Av. So I said, now I know why it's called Rav-Kav. That was terrific. Psak halacha from a driver who most probably was Misorati, but not wearing a kippah. And he gives me a psak halacha. I said, I think you're right. Because Shachianu can be done, you know, afterwards also. Like other things, like Goymel. There's also a required time that you should say, a person's sick. So when do you say Goymel? So the answer is when you're back on your feet, as if to say. It doesn't have to be full recuperation, but at least you're out of mortal danger and so on. But, you know, and if you do it a week later or 3 weeks later, it's also okay. There are some Paishkim who say that if a child goes under emergency operation and he's 5 years old, so who should say Goymel? At his bar mitzvah, he'll say Goymel. I know. No, I'm not joking. I've had this already. Why do you have to have? Some people say his father should say Goymel. Why should his father say Goymel? And why should he say Goymel as a katan where it may not have status yet? Being that you're allowed to delay the Goymel, so you delay the Goymel 8 years. Just remember that at his bar mitzvah, he should say Berchus Goymel for what happened when he was 5 years old. So these things, you know, tolerate delay. They sovel dichui, as we say. So therefore, when the Gemara says that Beit Aviv, who your show, father died and he's the inherent, why do you have to say the Shechianu Atova Meitiv immediately? Why can't you wait? So Dr. Greenwald said, because the subconscious is happy. We call Tat Hakara or Tat Muda. The Chazal were aware of what it took the world of psychology, Sigmund Freud and others, to understand that there is a subconscious. And the subconscious is reality, and the subconscious is dancing, you know, for joy, because a person just inherited a million, or millions, and that expression has to be given, right then and there. You're not going to realize it later down the road. It's now. It's at this moment. It's tremendous. It's the subconscious is in ecstasy, so there's a contradiction between the conscious feeling and experience and the subconscious. And the Chazal say we have to take both into consideration. And that's why you have to make both brachot at the time of the death and the Yerusha. And this idea that Chazal were aware of the subconscious plays a role, apparently, in other halachot as well. In other halachot. I'll give you an example before we get to another source on the daf. The ego, the ego of a person, that's himself, capital I. So I remember the Rav Zichron Levracha, when he used to talk about tshuva, he used to talk about two capital I, the authentic I, not I, you know, eyes, I, capital I, Anochi, me, capital I. So the authentic I and the phony I. He used to use that word, phony I. It's not really you. It's not really you. It's you, but it's not really you. Almost like you're a split personality to a certain degree. And as a split personality, one side of you is doing something against the will of the other side. And that is the phony I is performing against the will of the authentic I. And this is how the Rav understood what tshuva is all about. Because when the Torah says tshuva, it means returning to God, right? Vishav, vishav, lekecha, tshvutcha, v'rechamecha, vishav. You're returning to God. That's how we use the word tshuva. But the Rav gave a different slant to it. He says what's happening is that the phony I is returning to the authentic I. You're going back, they're turning back. The phony I is dictating to you what to do, and it's wrong. And when you have that phony I return itself to the authentic personality, that's tshuva. Because the authentic personality always wants to be in line with a Kadosh Baruch Hu's will, because that's what a neshama is. That's what a neshama is. It's that spiritual component of the human being that's longing for connecting to God. The problem is that we become phony and we deviate from it and we create a false personality. To a certain degree, like acting. Remember when those of us who were in the cemetery in Poland, so there's a little space where there are actors and actresses who are buried there. And I pointed out in the late 19th century, there was a thriving Jewish theater, Yiddish theater, that exists until this very day. They actually just sold it this year. But it's called the Esther Kaminsky Theater. Some of us may have remembered the daughter, Ida Kaminsky. She was in the Yiddish, my mother took us to Yidl, Mitten, Fiedel, all these in the Lower East Side.
That
Yeah. So this is the mother. Her name was Esther Rochel Kaminska, and she founded the theater, and there were other actors there. Their matzevot was so interesting that they put masks on the matzeva. Like the matzeva itself has a picture of a person with a mask. So the truth is, what were they trying to say? When you're acting, whether on stage or in a film, you're not your real self. You're a phony. You're acting another part. You're acting a part of somebody else, essentially. And it makes not one bit of a difference who you really are, because that's not really what's important. There was a movie that was produced here in Israel called HaHesder. It was about Yeshivot Hesder. And it was a story about a right-wing, super hyper right-wing yeshiva, Hesder, with a Rosh Yeshiva was giving off all kinds of ideas to the students, and one of the students took it to the 10th power and thought that the Rosh Yeshiva was saying they should blow up the mosques on Har HaBayit. That was the movie. I mean, imagine, it was produced by leftist theater people in this country. So, but in order to write that movie, they had to really understand the world of Yeshivot Hesder, not only the extremists, but what it means. And of course, Yeshivat Hesder probably has a girlfriend who's in Shevut Lumi. So there's an actress in this country. She's not religious. Her name is Tinkerbell, of all things. That's her name, Tinkerbell. That's a nickname that she has. And she went to Migdal Oz, to the Midrashah, for months to sit with the girls to live the life of an ulpanist, to understand, so that when she does the part, it becomes second nature already, because she didn't grow up in that environment. To know exactly how to dress, what the nuances are, and if you get married, does the tichel go to here? Does it go to here? And does the kippah this way? Is the kippah that way? And how big the kippah sugah is supposed to be? All this stuff, the ulpana girls, they know it. There's no shir, there's no class. It's just by watching everybody else and so on. So who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hesder Yeshiva in this film? It was Asi Dayan. Asi Dayan was Moshe Dayan's son. I mean, he was a mushchat shein kamo. I mean, the man was a drug addict and everything. Asi Dayan, I want you to know, he played the part royally. Royally. I mean, you'd never in a million years think this was Asi Dayan. But we knew who Asi Dayan is. Everybody knew Asi Dayan. But he was a very, very good actor. He was able to learn the part and play it. So you can dress up as any way you want to dress up and play the part and so on. That's what acting is. The Rav said the phony eye is acting. Is acting. That's all it is. And tshuva is to remove the mask, to remove the costume, and get back to the authentic I, capital I, who you really are. So this also says that the phony eye and the real I, there's a split personality. That's an issue in psychology of split personality. There's no question that's a subject. I mean, there's schizophrenia, which I understand schizophrenia and split personality is not identical, but I have a hunch that schizophrenia was identified by great Gedolei Yisrael of the last 500 years, except they didn't call it schizophrenia. They called it a dibbuk. Sholem Aleichem's book, play the dibbuk. So what was the dibbuk? I mean, you've got somebody who's playing out somebody else, right? The book Sybil. So she suffered, this was a real story, I think it was 8 personality types, and would be able to switch, like you push a button and all of a sudden she's somebody else. And she was like playing the role of a man, of a woman. It was unbelievable. And they really studied her to understand this psychiatric disorder. You can't say that she's normal. It clearly wasn't normal. But when you start working through normalcy, so you start with the extreme, and normal simply becomes some type of awareness of what's correct and what goes on amongst the masses. So that becomes normal. But normality can switch also, can shift. And what was normal in one generation could be abnormal in another generation. And we're witness to this to this very day. Things have shifted to some degree. So when somebody talks about split personality, the I authentic and I phony, that's a split personality type. Dybbuk was even more extreme. And of course, the way they try to solve it, there's the Chofetz Chaim stories about trying to get the dybbuk out of a person. That's dybbuk from the word dafek, something attached to yourself inside. And it's like another being inside you that has to be somehow expunged and taken out. But whether the the rabbinic therapist had a handle on this or not, that's not the issue. But apparently, these symptoms were there, that there was schizophrenia out there, and split personality. So if you take a look at source number six, source number six comes from the world of divorce, gerushin. Now, the ABC of gerushin, the ABC, is that you have to divorce. If a person is going to give a divorce, it has to be from his free will. You cannot coerce a divorce. You can't coerce a person to give a get. It has to be of his own free will. So if you just backtrack... do I have it on the page here? No. There are other examples where the halakha also demands that it has to be with your totally free will. So I'll give you one example just to set the stage. Bring a korban to Beit HaMikdash. So in Vayikra, Perakimel, it says, Adam ki yakrivu became korban, Hashem, and so on, Vinabakar, Menavatzon, Yakrivu, it says, Lifnei Hashem, Lirtzono, Lifnei Hashem. Lirtzono means you have to will, that you have to be in the willing partner to the bringing of the korban. But it says, Yakrivoto, you shall offer the korban. So Chazal say, you shall offer the korban even if you don't want to. Kofinoto, we force him, we twist his arm, we pressure him to bring that korban. If he did a sin that he's obligated to bring a sacrifice to Beit HaMikdash, kofinoto, ad shiomar rotzeani, until he says, all right, I'm willing. One second. That seems to be a little bit of a joke. What is he saying, rotzeani? Just stop the pressure. You know, he's succumbing to the pressure, really. But does he really want to bring the korban? You're pressuring him, you're beating him physically, whatever, financially, socially. You've ostracized him, you put up signs in shul, he can't get an aliyah, he's a chayrim. The guy doesn't want to live with that. So, all right, fine. So I'll bring the korban already. You know, like, get them off my back, essentially. So that's called dirtzano, kofinoto achi omar rotzeani. So what happens with gerushin? The problem with gerushin is that there's a concept called get me'usa. Get me'usa means a coerced divorce. And get me'usa is pasul, is disqualified. So how can you have kofin oto achi yomar rotzeani on a get? If you're going to apply pressure, and he's going to eventually collapse and say, all right, I'll give her the get, because he wants you to bug off, he wants you to get the pressure off, how can you say it's a valid get? It's classic get me'usa. So the Rambam says as follows. Misha Adin, source number six. Misha Adin Noten, Shekofin Oto, the Garesh at Ishto, Veloratza the Garesh. There can be a scenario where while a woman doesn't administer a get, she actually can open up a file at the Beit Din to get the Dayanim to hear her story. So perhaps they'll be convinced that her story is on the level and they will force the husband to give a get. Of course, the husband comes and says, no, I never did anything, I didn't abuse her, I didn't do that. But if the woman can make her case, you know, successfully, convincingly, and the dayanim realize that this woman really has to get out of this marriage, and the husband does not want to give the get, there are pressure tactics that the dayanim have at their disposal to guarantee that he gives the get. Like in this country, surrendering, taking away your driver's license, your passport, until putting you in jail. Yeah. The fact is, the Beit Din doesn't always use those powers. But they have the authority to do so. They get the police to lock the guy up, or take away his passport, the guy can't travel, take away his driver's license, limit him in all kinds of ways, until he comes through with the get. So the Rambam says, Misha din noten, shekofin oto legaresh et ishto. If the circumstance has it that the husband should be giving his wife the divorce, v'lo ratzeh legaresh, but he's refusing, Beit Din shel Yisrael b'chol makom b'chol zman. Beit Din throughout doesn't mean just Eretz Yisrael. Anywhere, any recognized Beit Din has the authority. Makin oto ad shiyomar rotzeani. So makin, does it mean physical beating? It could be in those countries where that's a legitimate way of punishing. But it also means pressure, whether communal pressure, economic pressure, social pressure. Makin oto ad shiyomar rotzeani. V'ichtov aget v'uget kasher. He'll write the get, and the get is kosher divorce. So the Rambam now, and he goes on to say, and even if Goyim, let's assume the woman petitions a civil court, And she has the non-Jewish judges agree that she wants out and deserves to get out of this marriage. And the non-Jewish judiciary orders the religious court to force the guy to give a get. So now the pressure is coming twofold. It's coming from non-Jewish sources from the outside and also on the Beit Din. And finally the guy cracks and he gives the get. Rambam says it's a get. It's a kosher divorce. I mean, here it's obviously all this is under pressure. So Rambam has to explain how this works. So if you just look to the third line in the middle where it is dot dot dot. Aval mi shetokvo yitzro hara levatel mitzvah o lasot avera vehuka ad she'asa davar shechayav lasoto o ad she'nitrachek midavar she'asur lasoto ein ze anus mimenu ela anas atzmo bedato hara'a. Rambam has an unbelievable theory here. That a person is saying no, he doesn't want to give his wife a divorce. Or he says, I don't want to bring a korban even though you're telling me I'm obligated. Or I don't want to give tzedakah in a community that I'm obliged to participate in the tzedakah needs. And I don't want to give a half a shekel for machzit a shekel in Beit HaMikdash. All of these are examples where halacha says, kofinoto, that we force. All of these cases. It's not the I authenti that's talking. It's the phony I. And the phony I, the Rambam says, is a person's yetzer hara. So who's getting the pressure? Who's getting the beating? The yetzer hara. So we're beating the brains out of the yetzer hara. So the yetzer hara is ready on the mat, knocked out, and the person says, Rotze ani, that's the authentic I that has made that statement. This is the Rambam. You know, he's not a Kabbalist. This is the Rambam. He's a halachic purist. The person, this man who refused to deliver a get. He does want to be part of Klal Yisrael. He's not rejecting the fact that he's Jewish. He really, deep down, wants to fulfill the commandments. And to distance himself from sin. The Yitzrohu shetokfo. It's this Yitzhara that's got the better of him. The Kevat Shuka, Acha Tashesh Yitzro. Now that he's getting beaten up until the Yitzhara collapses, the Amar, and the man says, Rotzani, Kvar Geresh Mirutzano. This is called a Gereshin from free will, because it's the I authentic that has said Rotzani, and no longer are we hearing the phony I. It's an unbelievable understanding. And he says, and you hear the Rambam is now identifying the Yetzer Hara as part of the person's subconscious. And we can work with this now in the halacha. That's a tremendous chiddush. This I didn't hear from Dr. Greenwald. This is already add-on now that others have drew my attention. And our great Rebbe, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and I can tell you that I first began to appreciate this Rambam when I struggled to read an article in English from our great Rebbe, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichron Lebrachot, Rav son-in-law. So let me just say, I heard shiurim from Rav Aaron back in YU in 1971. I wasn't in the shiur yet, but I used to sometimes drop in. And I saw that you had to bring three svarim to the shiur: a Gemara, a Rambam, and a Webster's Dictionary. Not necessarily in that order. I mean, Rav Aaron spoke literary English. That, you know, especially if you came from Brooklyn, who didn't even speak English. We spoke Brooklynese. So that's a different language completely. And those who spoke yeshivish, you know, that's another language. Rav Aaron spoke a high-powered English that was sustainable only person who was an English literature major, as he was from Harvard University. So I remember when Rabbi Sachs from London, now he's located in New York, but he comes here occasionally. So he's also, I mean, he's British, you know, you expect a wonderful speaker. So he was touring the States as a speaker a few years ago when my son, the pilot, was in Florida. And I heard saw an ad that in Miami Beach, Rabbi Sachs was giving a talk. I told my son, go listen to him. Even if you don't understand one word, you'll learn some English. You're going to pick up a few new words, for sure. For sure, it's such a pleasure to listen to him. So Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein writes this article called Religion and State, The Case for Interaction in a major, major journal called Judaism back in 1966. It was reprinted in a Yeshiva University student publication called Gesher in 1969, and that's where I know it from. And Rav Aaron there basically deals, it's an article that was almost written against Yeshayahu Leibovitz, who claimed that religious legislation in the Knesset is nothing but a chil Hashem, because the Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us mitzvot, and we don't need 120 members of the Knesset. Well, some aren't Jewish, some are Jewish but not religious, they don't believe in God, they have to raise their hands on religious legislation. He said it's a chil Hashem, that's what Leibovitz claimed. Rav Aaron talks about interaction, that there is room for religious legislation on some level, and he gives parameters which areas, you know, it could work and which areas it's best that it should not be introduced. And I say this against the background of the vote in the Knesset that was postponed now for a week on the Chok HaMarkulim about, you know, which makolets can be opened, and food stores can be opened on Shabbat, which can't be opened on Shabbat. And all of a sudden you find out that, you know, Tel Aviv doesn't have Shabbat and Yerushalayim does have Shabbat, which is in itself an issue that religious members of the Knesset and ministers are pushing for a law that basically is going to sanction Chil Shabbos in certain areas, which is a little bit crazy, and in name of that in other areas there won't be Chil Shabbos. Now, I'm not saying that that doesn't have value, because Yadut is never based on an all or nothing premise. So if politically we can get something, but not everything, so the something is also important. I'm happy that Aryeh Deri apologized to Yehuda Glick, who we totally, totally send our tanchumim on the loss of his wife, Yafi, Aleha Shalom. And the idea that Yehuda should get up from his shiva chair and run to the Knesset and vote, because they needed his vote, he apologized, and I'm glad. Okay, shtickle mensch at the end of the day. But it was just a bush of a cherpa to even suggest that he should ask the Rav of the Otniel to give him a heta, and I know Rav Raima Cohen, and he didn't want to do that. He said, this is not a halachic issue, it's a human issue, just leave him alone, and you're the smart boy, and that's it. So they ended up pushing the vote to next week, that's what.
Big deal.
What?
Big deal.
So this is issues of religious legislation. So Rav Lichtenstein quoted this Gemara, this Rambam, but more important, this Rambam is source number 7, the Or Sameach on this Rambam. Who is the Or Sameach? Or Sameach's name is Rav Meir Simcha HaKoyen from Dvinsk. So Dvinsk, we know where the town is today. It's in Belarus. There were two Torah luminaries there. One was Hasidic. He was the Rogach of a Goyen, Rav Yosef Ruzin. And the Litvak, Misnagid, was Rav Meir Simcha HaKoyen. And he wrote a svarim that you can hear his name. His name is Meir Simcha. The name of the book is Or Sameach. And also he wrote the Perish on Chumash, Meshech Chochma. So Meshech is Mem Shin Chaf, which is the abbreviation of Meir Simcha HaKoyen. Those of you who remember Rabbi Professor Meir Simcha HaKoyen Feldblum, Zichron Levracha. Yeah, he was my teacher also. So he was a great grandson of the Or Sameach, and was named after him. Yeah, you didn't know. He was a Nin, Or Enikel, the Or Sameach, and was called Meir Simcha HaKoyen, carried his name. So the Meshech Chochma, or the Or Sameach, popularly known as the Or Sameach, because of his great sefer that he wrote on the Rambam. So he writes as follows, in source number 7. V'cheivan shezachinu lezeh, after a long, long discussion, he says, and now that we've arrived at my conclusion, I'll tell you in a moment what the conclusion is, ati shapir, everything works out fine. What kind of conclusion is he saying? Or Sameach says, you know when this theory of the Rambam works, that every person really deep down wants to be a Torah observant Jew, and if this particular fellow isn't, so the Yetzer Hara got better of him, so let's knock the brains out of the Yetzer Hara, and then when he finally says, Rotzeh Ani, it's pure, it's authentic, and then, you know what it works? It works when society at large is a religious society, where almost everybody is a Shomer Torah Mitzvot. And normally speaking, people are in line with the norms of the community. People don't like to be outsiders and exceptionals and so on. So a person who grows up in a religious neighborhood, even though the person may not be 100% religious, but there's certain things he's not going to do, because, as they say, it's posnish. It doesn't look well, you know, in the neighborhood and so on. So then, you know, you can argue and say, deep down he really wants to be a Shomer Torah Mitzvot. He believes in a Kadosh Baruch Hu, he believes in Matan Torah, but he's looking for an easy way out, you know, it's more convenient not to be religious and so on. So that's the Yetzer Hara factor that can be dealt with. But if society at large is not religious, a secular society, And secularism hit European Jewry, Ashkenazi Jewry, 300 years ago with emancipation, when the walls of the ghettos fell. You know, we say ghetto, we think Warsaw ghetto and Kovno ghetto, but the word ghetto is an Italian word, which means secluded, separated sections. And the church separated Jews from residential areas. So we were in ghetto alt, not the Warsaw ghetto. We lived very nicely, by the way. And it turned out, this klola turned out to be a big bracha, because the separation guaranteed the preservation of Yadut. And it was the first Rebbe of Chabad, the author of the Tanya, Rav Shneur Zalman Vliadi, favored the Tsar of Russia over Napoleon in the Napoleonic Wars, because he said the liberté, the freedom that's going to happen, is going to be a churban for Am Yisrael. Because now Jews are going to be free and they're going to get rights and so on. They're going to intermarry and assimilate. He called it as perfectly, perfectly. Of course, why were most Rabbanim in favor of Napoleon? Because they had it with persecution already. You know, they wanted a little bit air to breathe. They needed to breathe a little bit. And so on. Of course, the Rav Sham Shofar Hirsch saw it differently. He saw it as a very positive development, the emancipation and so on, with that went with challenges. There's no question. It was easier to remain Shomer Torah Mitzvot under persecution than not under persecution. But that doesn't mean we favor persecution. I'll just digress for a second. Remember when they had in the late 60s and early 70s, all the rallies for Soviet Jewry. Some of us will remember SSSJ, Student Struggle for Soviet Jewry. Remember, we used to go with the plakatim, you know, and pictures of people we know, like, you know, Yossi Mendelevich and Natan Sharansky and so on. They were all in jail at the time, refuseniks, seruvnikim. So there were a handful of rabbanim who were against this. A handful. I'm not going to go into which ones and why. And what was one of the rationales was, now that they're in the Soviet Union and they're not Shomrei Torah Mitzvot, so they're anusim. God won't hold them accountable. But you know, God forbid, they're going to let them out and come to America or to Eretz Yisrael, and they're not going to be religious. Ah, now it's going to be more serious. So it's better for them to be cooped up in the Soviet Union, you know. And so then, the Rav didn't buy that at all. And he encouraged us barely to go to the demonstration. He encouraged his own son-in-law, Rabban Lichtenstein, to close the koilet on a particular Sunday to go to the demonstration. He said he doesn't want to violate the same Avera twice in one lifetime of Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa. He said he felt so guilty of what happened during the days of World War II. He said American Jewry did not do enough to jolt the White House and jolt the administration into doing things to save Jews. And the Rav said, I'm not going to go through same Avera twice in one lifetime. And therefore, if the Soviet Jews want out, you know, we have to do everything to bring them out. And that won the day. Obviously, that won the day. Brought down the Soviet Union. Nobody expected that to happen. But the idea that in a non-religious society that you did not have in North Africa, and certainly not in Yemen. Yemen, the first time secularism hits the Yemenite Jewish community is here in Eretz Yisrael in 1950. First time that it hits. Before that, there was no such thing as a non-religious Yemenite Jew. And even North Africa, amongst the Moroccan community, the Tunisian, the Libyan, the Egyptian, and then the Iraqi community. So there, they were very solidly traditional. Maybe not as scrupulous in the halakhic observance, but certainly not secularist. Secularism was an Ashkenazi European phenomenon, and that's where Zionism was born. You know, on European turf, in a secular society, right? Herzl wasn't, Belzer Chosid. And so we do understand that, where it's coming from. That's why there was opposition to political Zionism in its earlier stages, except for the Mizrahi, who had foresight to see that something great is going to come out of all this. But most of the religious Jews of the 19th and 20th century were against it, vehemently against it. So, because it was all secular enterprise. And as a secular enterprise, the Or Sameach says, in that environment, you cannot enforce coercion at all. At all. Because it's going to backfire. It's going to backfire. There you cannot assume that the authentic I really wants to be Shomrei Torah and Mitzvot. They are not there. They're just not there. If you take a look at the words in source number 7, he says, Kevan shezachinu lezeh alti shapir. It comes out good. The emat amar Rabbeinu. When does the Rambam say ta'ama, the reason that the get would be a kosher get, the mitzvah lishmoa divrei chachamim, because there's a commandment to listen to what the chachamim are telling you to do, dafke b'mi shemachzik b'torat Hashem, somebody who is committed to Torah Hashem, then you can say this, and you can say that
His behavior is the phony I. It's an aberration, and we can knock it on the head and try to deal with it. He really deep down wants to be on the right path. Somebody who's left the fold because he's got a broikus with God, because he's theologically not there at all, that's a completely different story. And that's what Rav Aaron said, that with regard to religious legislation here in Israel, we have to be careful what type of religious legislation we want to legislate in the Knesset, because if it's going to be something that the majority of the people cannot accept, it's going to lead to a Chilul Hashem, and it's not worth it. Yeah.
The opposite side of the coin is that at one time, the government was not only secularist, but anti-religious.
There was some.
The thing with the cutting off at the payout.
Okay, that happened
and,
with
look. Putting them on non-religious kibbutzim where there's no Shabbos, there's no.
Okay, the final word on how the government of Ben Gurion handled the Yemenite Aliyah has not been written, although everybody knows it's not going to be a great story. It is a great story on one level, having brought them. That's a great story. There's no question. The operation of Marvadaksa. You know, the magic carpet, the way they brought them, there's no question that's a great story. But what happened immediately afterwards is a bleak story, and there were families where their children were taken away from them. We all know this day. It's coming out now. Officially, documents are being released, and that's very helpful that for parents who are now aged to come to terms with what happened. Maybe one day through genetic testing, they're going to discover who their own children are, and so on. Now, one of the reasons that this was done to try to put them in Chiloni kibbutzim and so on and make these kids secular, it was a political calculation as well, because they didn't want the country to develop into a religious majority, which is something that they fear today. Right? They just announced statistics that there are now 1 million Haredim in Eretz Israel. Now, there are 9 million people in Israel, of which 6 point something are Jews. So, 1 million already Haredim. And then you have Dati Lumi, which is more than 1 million, by the way. There's more than 1 million. There's more Dati Lumi than Haredim. So, you don't think that the secular world in Israel are not running scared that it's only a question of time that the Dati community is going to take over? It's happening already. The head of the Shabak is Dati, the head of the police is Dati, the head of many, 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 soon the head of the army is going to be Dati. It's only a question, and it almost was already, almost happened already. So all these things are happening. They're all happening, and that's right, the country is going to be run by religious people. Now, the great hope is that the people who are religious, who are running it, believe in the state and its institutions. So that's a different question. But I think there's a very, very strong movement in the Haredi world to be more and more accepting of government in general and government institutions. There are two very, very important manifestations of this. And one is that more and more of the youth of the Haredi movement are going to the army. That's very important. And the second is jobs. More and more schools, professional schools have opened up in Yerushalayim the last few years for Haredi men, Haredi women, because they want to work. Because they don't want this business of sitting 20 years in a kollel. They realize that it's over. The party's over, and they want to go to work. And that once you join the mainstream in the country, then you feel the pulse of the country much more. You're more involved in it, and so on. And I think that's very, very important. You get swept up a little bit in the environment of it. Just 2 nights ago, I spent a day at the Renaissance for an international rabbis conference. So in the evening there was a wonderful, wonderful presentation about Entebbe. They actually had one of the pilots from Entebbe from 76, and they had somebody who was a 6-year-old boy, one of the hostages. He's now grown up already with his own kids. And they were being interviewed by Avi Rat. It was a sensational, sensational program. And they showed film clips from it and so on. And then there was a concert of the Yonatan and Aaron Razael, the two brothers. It was a very nice evening. The end of the evening is singing of Ani Ma'amin and Atikva. Okay. Now some people came there, and they brought their grandchildren. You can see he was a grandchild. And you can see grandchildren with, you know, oversized black hats. you know, the grandparents are Mizrahi people, and they were blessed with grandchildren who are learning in Talmud Torahs and Yeshiva Ketanas and so on. Besides that, but you know, Jewish music is Jewish music. It was all very kosher and everything. And I saw this guy, he didn't look more than 13, 14 years old. Big black hat. I don't think I could fit into that hat. But okay, maybe he wore it because of an umbrella. Maybe it was, it doubled as an umbrella. Maybe that's what it was. But the Beseda, it was a very sweet looking boy. And I was watching him during Atikva. So you see, he was uncomfortable. And as the song progressed, he starts mouthing out the words. Now, maybe he didn't realize what he was doing, but he got caught up in the sweep. Got caught up in it. It was so charged. It was so beautiful that, you know, how could you stand there, you know, like as a protest? There was somebody who protested, and even very publicly, and that was the saxophone player of the band for Aaron and Yonatan Razel, who both of them led the Hatikva. But he stood there with a big black yarmulke and a beard, and he didn't sing the Hatikva. Big tzaddik, you know? Big tzaddik, you know? If you didn't want to do it, walk off the stage at least. At least walk off the stage. No, you have to, but for Hesse, I mean, Mavish for Hesse. But that, I was watching that boy. I said, ah, look at this. It's not his fault. It's his the education and so on. And then as the song progressed, you see, you started mouthing it out. You know, Leo Tom Chofshi Bartzenu, Eretz Tzion Yerushalayim. He was with us. So these things, you know, indeed do happen. So, but the Or Sameach says there are societies where it just doesn't happen. And Rav Aaron used this Or Sameach to make his case about how we should use with religious education. Let's go back to source number one for a moment. We're not going to be able to do all the sources today, but we'll continue this next week with some additional material. Source number one is very famous. Amar Rav Huna, Kevan she'avar Adam Avera v'shanaba, person does an Avera and repeats the Avera second time around, hutralo, it becomes permissible for him. Mara says, hutralo salkadato? You mean really it becomes mutar? Just because you did the Avera second time, now it's it becomes mutar? So Mara says, no, Ela'ema suggests, na'aset lo ke'eter. To him, it's already permissible. Now, what's going on here? This is the beginning of habit forming. You do something, you know it's wrong. But you do it second time around, hey, the world didn't cave in the first time, so now you can do it again. Not such a worse thing. Says the Kotzke Rebbe, Rabbi Nachum Mendel from Kotzke. Why doesn't the Gemara say the third time? What about the third time? Third time it's already a mitzvah. Second time it was a heter, it was permissible. But third time it really became a mitzvah. In other words, you get so locked into your own behavior and you rationalize it. Nobody wants to say, oh, I'm a Russia. Who cares? I'm a Russia. Nobody wants to think that they're a Russia. They think they're a tzaddik. Everybody thinks they're a tzaddik. The Rav Yisroel, you've heard this from me many times, the Rav Yisroel talk about the people who said, Yavidu and Slichas, or Shamnu Bagadnu, you know, on the next guy. It wasn't me, it was him. So this is a real problem. So Nasus Geheta, third time you're a tzaddik, you know, of course I'm okay, and I'm Seder. So that's why tshuva is really behavioral modification. And that's a subject in psychology. It's behavioral modification. You get locked into a certain mode. And what's interesting is that, while on the one hand, if you do it once, twice, third time, the Rambam in source number two says that there's a concept of first-time offenders. And we know this in Mishpat, in law. You know, sometimes you're speeding on the cop sees it and gives you a ticket. And you go to court and they see that you've never ever gotten a ticket for speeding. In all likelihood, they'll let you off, or the marginal type of fine. Because that's called first time. All right, no, be careful. Don't do it again. So the Rambam says, b'sha'ash shoklim avonot adam b'schuyotav, when the Kadosh Baruch Hu is measuring and weighing person's sins with his mitzvot, ein mechashvim alav avon shechata bo tchila. We don't measure first-time offenders. First time it didn't have error, it doesn't go into the shizel. It doesn't go into the calculation. V'lo sheni, not the second time either. Elach mishlishi ve'elach. Ah, you did a third time. Im nimtzu avonotav mishlishi ve'elach merubim al zchuyotav, otam shtei avonot mitztarfim v'danim otam al hakol. So if you did the same error three times, and the pekel of avarot override the mitzvahs, you're going to get punished for the first two also. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not using the first two in the calculation of the weight of mitzvot against averot. So you have this concept of first-time offenders, second-time offender. So there's a little bit of a hakala, leniency of sorts. But the Rav once said that sometimes if you become a habitual avera, it's also a reduced charge. Even though the first time, the second time, you knew exactly what you were doing. You knew it was an avera, you know it's wrong, and so chazal, you're doing it. For whatever reason, you're doing it. But then by the fifth time, by the sixth time, by the second, tenth time, by the hundredth time, you don't even think anymore. You're now a robot. You've been conditioned to do that mode of behavior. So because the subsequent times are not based on free will any longer, it becomes less weighty of an avera. That's really unbelievable. That the factor of habit kicks in, it takes away the burden and responsibility of free will. Now, if you just look at source number 3, we really don't have a lot of time for this, but I'll do it anyway. There are two different avirot of avodah zarah. One is one person serves idolatry. The other is, there was a campaign in the city to get everybody in the city to serve idolatry. So the first is called an oved avodah zarah, served idolatry, it's an avera. The second is called ir hanidachat, that it was pushed, the city was pushed to become an idolatrous city. Now we know that severity of avirot can be measured by the order of the capital punishment. It's not that there are four capital punishments, skilas, refa, herig, and chenek, but the order is significant. What comes first is more serious than what comes second, what comes third, what comes fourth. And the proof is, if you look at source number 3, there's a machloket about the order. The Mishnah says, arba mitot nimsaru lebeitin. There are four types of modes of execution. Skila, which is stoning, srefa, burning, herig, decapitation, chenek, is choking, like hanging. Rav Shimon Omer, no, it's srefa, skila, chenek, and herig. So if I take the list that we know it from the Machzor of Yom Kippur, Al Chataim Shanu Chayaleim Arba Mitot Beitin, and it spells it out, Skila Srefa Herkanek. So let's call them 1, 2, 3, and 4. Rabbi Shimon has it as 2, 1, 4, and 3. Srefa, Skila, Chenek, and Hereg. So that's 2, 1, 4, and 3. And by us it's 1, 2, 3, 4, Skila, Srefa, Hereg, and Chenek. But what's important in both lists, Skila is more serious than Hereg. If you look at the next line, it says, Elohena Niskalim, who are those who get skila? So it gives all kinds of examples, and the last one on the second line is, Hoved Avodah Zarah. That's the most serious, like Chil Shabbat, is skila. Now we don't have a Beit Din that does these anymore, but at least we can learn something about the severity of the Avera. In source number 4, it says, Elohena Neheragim, that's already decapitation, Harutzeach Ve'anshei Irhanitachan. One second, Iridaka is also idolatrous worship. It's idolatrous worship. So what's the difference if the whole city serves Avodah Zarah or one guy serves Avodah Zarah? In Iridaka, it's mob psychology. Remember that concept? And then where mobs ruled, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled correctly that in mob psychology, you can't hold every individual to the same level as if the person would do it on his own. Because you get caught up in a frenzy of the mob. And everybody's doing it, and everybody's running, and everybody's shooting, and everybody's blowing, and so on. Everybody's doing it by the Zara. So you get caught up in that, so it's a reduced charge. Now, it's also a capital punishment, but it's a capital punishment that's of a lesser order than Avodah Zara. So Avodah Zara is the most serious, it's Skila. Whether it's the Chacham's list, Skila Sreifa, or the Rav Shimon's list, Sreifa Skila, it's going to be before Herod, in both cases, which indicates that the Torah took mob psychology into effect with the halacha and so on. That's very, very important. Very important. So psychology is not a discipline that was discovered in the 19th century and developed in the 20th, 21st century. It's something that's been around. It's been made into a science. You know, it's been organized as a discipline. That, yes, that for sure, in the modern era, just like mathematics and science in general. But it doesn't mean it wasn't around. Doesn't mean people weren't aware of the Torah HaNefesh that we have in the psychology. So we have all these various ideas, and I said that last insight from the Rav is dynamite, that as a person progresses with a mode of Avera, the seriousness between him and HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually diminishes because he's now become a robot. And Avera is predicated on free will. And if there's no free will, and this is an issue of Parshat HaShavua next week, of Va'era and Bo. Did Paro have free will? If Kadosh Baruch Hu keeps saying that I'm going to, you know, have him go on and go on and go on until the 10th Makkah, where is the free will? And the Ramban deals with it. Maybe next week I'll touch on it, because it'll already be Parshat HaShavua, because that is a cardinal issue about punishing Paro, where it seems that he was denied free will. How can you punish somebody who doesn't have a free choice to make a choice for good or for bad? Okay, so if you want to just leave the pages there, I'll bring them next week. Plus, I'll leave them print on the second side, a whole slew of new words.
Okay.
Thank you.